In the name of God, who is Trinity and Unity. Amen. I've been looking at statistics lately. This is really not my preferred method for learning lessons, though. I find numbers as arid as I find images thirst-quenching. Give me the glory of a Gothic fan-vaulted ceiling over the taxonomy of percentages any day. I have not been watching figures frantically because I want to resist replacing names with numbers. The innumerability, or at least the overwhelming experience of large numbers, sometimes gives us an excuse to bow out. It's disturbingly easy to avoid the reality of a person in a hospital bed in Delhi or Mumbai if we stick to listening to reports about fearful figures in the millions. Our hearts are tugged differently by a personal story and a collective one. Nevertheless, I am finding myself snagged by the stats. They appear like stark sentinels in articles about women's struggles with Zoom fatigue, the pressures of long COVID, or the way that insurance companies inhibit care homes from making humane decisions. Here's just one of those numbers. According to Oxfam, COVID-19 could push 500 million people into poverty, in addition to those who are already bearing the unjust indignities of hunger, homelessness, and desperation. We also know that minorities have suffered most at the hands of this pandemic. So if this is the new normal, I say no thank you. But of course I can't do that, and neither can you. We can't bow out or go off grid or refuse to open our eyes. Seeing, both physically and figuratively, links our readings from Job and the Gospel of Mark, together with the question of what the new normal might be and what it might teach us. Whether our eyes are open or closed, seeing the pandemic might mean hospitals and ventilators, masks as personal fashion statements, or faces in grids on Teams and Zoom. It might mean seeing footage of a policeman murdering George Floyd, or the transformative Black Lives Matter protests that followed. We have 18 months of images to choose from, personal and collective. When you close your eyes, what do you see? And moreover, what has not been seen or revealed? And what do we refuse to look at? Bartimaeus, blind and resourceless in the Gospel of Mark, uses his voice. He calls out to Jesus boldly enough to be scorned and scolded. The people around him and Jesus could have pretended not to hear him. Instead, he must be so loud. They tell him to shut up. He is loud enough to break through their apathy and to expose it. Bartimaeus knows what he wants. He will not be silenced. He asks for it directly. This is the boldness of someone who simultaneously trusts the hearer and knows he has nothing to lose in speaking. He sees. And he is the only healed person in Mark's gospel who is named. He asks, he receives, he is named. And of course, it is not he who has been blind at all. In his heart's and mind's eye, he saw and knew Jesus. It is those who silence him who are blind. When it comes to suffering, in the sin of racism and in the throes of a health crisis, there has been so much blindness. It is time to see. Job, in his final conversation with God after his world has been stripped away from him, learns new lessons about change and about seeing. He doesn't get his old life back. Amongst what looks like a fairy tale ending with thousands of camels and donkeys, there are children. The sons are not named, though. The daughters are. The daughters will inherit. The women are given new power. This is a revolution hidden like a little jewel at the end of a long, hard journey. Job's response to all he's learned about God changes the ways he is distributing his resources, and he seems to be doing it genuinely subversively and for the dignity of all. And this new relationship with God, family, and community, personal and collective, is because, as Job puts it, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. As Christians, we proclaim that all humanity, all creation, is interconnected without exception, and that has consequences for us. As long as my neighbor is not free, I am not free, and neither are you. Because of God's unceasing love and its implications for our imperiled planet, justice is not just an ambition, but a holy imperative. And thankfully, grace is not just a possibility, but a constant outpouring in truth and love. But insulated as many of us are from the brunt of this new normality's patterns of suffering in our world, it's strange to consider now that increasingly, my survival, or yours, is unlikely to truly depend on my neighbor's survival. This is a worrying potential byproduct of vaccination. Perhaps we would rather forget. Perhaps we would rather enter into the impossible idea of winding the clock back. And that's a kind of nostalgia that will erase our potential fruitful learning. But in seeing, listening, and lamenting, we have learned about mutuality. And I wonder now, will these lessons bear fruit in the building of more constructive ways of being together? Or will we just forget, unable to bear the weight of the learning and its costs? Will we tentatively learn to touch again? Or will we rush into each other's arms with wild abandon? I suspect for many and for all kinds of reasons, it will be the latter, whether it's in the gentle embrace of tenderness or the chaotic eagerness of the contact starved. Among the lessons learned, here is one thing that I hope we will leave behind, and one thing I hope we use to change our world for the better by entering into more and more deeply. Both are about mutuality, both are about seeing, and both are about repairing relationships that have been distorted by power. So here's the thing I hope we leave behind. I hope that what we could call the good guy hug disappears forever. May it be a distant memory cast into the annals of anthropological history from now on. This type of hug is given by a powerful man to someone with less power, usually a woman. It is impossible, I assure you, to refuse this hug without causing extreme awkwardness, if not outright humiliation, for the hugger and the huggy. Refusing would be risky and sometimes dangerous. By its very nature, it is simultaneously good-intentioned, usually, and non-consensual. It is a hug that proclaims, "I'm a good guy," while demonstrating that this well-meaning man hasn't considered the impact of his powerful embrace and its problematic patriarchy. I really pray that our culture's 18 months of refraining from touch like this will eradicate the good guy hug, though I'll admit I'm not optimistic. Here's the thing I really hope we keep and keep developing. I hope that we tenaciously continue to commit to anti-racism and to dismantling whiteness. White people like me, and perhaps we should and can put white in quotation marks along with race and those other terms which are relatively modern ones that keep us apart. White people like me have so much work to do to understand the harm done by racism, enslavement, and their traumatic legacies. The protests in the summer of 2020 are, I pray, creating a genuine culture shift with a tangible effect. Liberation, elevation, education, as Janelle Monáe would say. We have a chance to work together and get this right. And let's be clear that this is not about guilt, but about real change. Audre Lorde put this really well when she said that guilt is a response to one's own actions or lack of action. All too often, guilt is just another name for impotence, for defensiveness destructive of communication. It becomes a device to protect ignorance and the continuation of things the way they are, the ultimate protection for changelessness. One of the best things about being human is our capacity for positive change, even in dire circumstances. This is the way God made us. This is not just personal, it's collective. May we learn to see, to speak, and to feel. Amen.